Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me, as always, is a man that knows that when California tumbles into the sea, that'll be the day that he goes back to Annandale. Here is the captain.
That's the day we're all free. Free of our sins, my friends. It's good to be seen and good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
Today, we're still sipping on this double orange starfish, a delicious New England style pale ale. One of my favorite styles of pale ale is the New England style. This is by the good folks over at Aslin Beer Company, located in Alexandria, Virginia. This is a double India pale ale, double dry hopped. Delicious. And I love when we have something that is this good and it's in the ABV world of 8%. This is 8.3%. Yeah. Garage grade 4.5 bottle caps out of 5. How about some thanks and praise to our friends for helping us out with this week's show? First up, we got Jana Banana from Sacramento, California, who says she's buying a round for the people in the back. So shout out to Jana Banana. And last but certainly not least, we have Jenny Go, who said that she has moved to Seaford, Delaware, but is a lifelong Clevelander. I know we talk about Cleveland a lot on the show, Captain, but people go,
Cleveland rocks.
Anybody from Cleveland that ever emails the show or buys us around for the beer fund always points out, like, hey, I live here, but no mistake, I was born in Cleveland. So shout out to all the Clevelanders. Shout out to Jana Banana and Jenny Go for helping us out with this week's beer run.
Yeah, BWERUN beer run. If you need more True Crime Garage for your earballs, and you know you do, if you're listening right now on an Apple device, then pull out your phone, push the little subscribe button, and you can get off the record. That's right. Do it right now. Go ahead. You know you want to. And Colonel, that's enough of the business.
I have a question for you real quick, Captain.
Nope.
Do you know why people listen to Off the Record?
Because they're sexy.
Because they like it in their ears.
Dirty banana.
All right. Yeah, that's enough of the dirty business. Everybody gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime. We talked about on the first episode here, Captain, the 4 Colonial Parkway murders. And we now know in 2024 that Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. is responsible for what is the 3rd set of these double homicides, the one that falls 3rd on that timeline. Again, there's been debate over the years, are these 4 cases connected or not? Now, one thing I want to point out here that makes me believe that at least 2 of these 4 are absolutely connected is because it's not until the third case, 1988, April 10th, Keith Call, Cassandra Haley, the two that have never been found. It's my understanding, Captain, that that is when this man falls onto police radar, with witnesses coming forward saying, I've been approached, or we've been approached by a man that looks like this, who has a vehicle that looks like this. And they use those descriptions and that vanity plate to lead them to Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. Now, fast forward all those years later, we know that he killed David Nobling and Robin Edwards about 6 months prior. So if he was active and he killed David Nobling and Robin Edwards, and he doesn't come onto the police radar until the investigation of Keith Call and Cassandra Haley 6 months later, to me, it stands to reason that he's very likely responsible for both of these cases. That's four of the eight victims. And then, unfortunately, we have the sad fact, and this is what will prevent, I believe, prevent them from ever saying 100% that he did kill Keith Call and Cassandra Haley. We've still not found their bodies all of these years later.
Right. So you want to be able to link his DNA to the victims.
And I don't think that that's going to be possible. Who knows? Let's stay glass half full here. Let's stay fluid in the situation. We don't know what new evidence could be uncovered.
I'm just glad to have a cup.
That's right. Tomorrow, next week, who knows what police will find? And these cold cases are heating up. I think that it's no mistake that they're telling us we figured out a lot of this information last June. We are doing a lot of work behind the scenes and did not feel it was necessary to present this to the public until January. So to me, that tells me a couple things. One, they're doing a lot of work behind the scenes. What is that work? Well, I think that they have said what they're not saying to us is that they've probably been trying to tie him to these cases and maybe some others and just have not been able to do so yet. Right. But I'm guessing, Captain, that in a lot of these scenarios, they have a situation where they're looking at it under the microscope and they're going, you know what? We can't rule him out. We're not going to go to the public and rule him out on anything because of the nature of this beast, right? That he could have been hunting and killing in this area. And we're already up to multiple counties that we can tie him to. And he got away with it until he was deceased. Even when he was on the radar, he gets away with it.
If he is responsible for all the Colonial Parkway murders, that's eight victims plus the other victim that they connected him to. That's nine.
Teresa Howell, yeah.
Right. I mean, so is that just the beginning?
Well, and here's the other thing, too. I think that there's been a bit of a misconception over the years at large, for the masses anyway.
Okay, explain.
With these eight victims of the Colonial Parkway murders, I think that it's just kind of thought that all eight of these victims, they fell prey to the predator because they were on the parkway that night. When in fact, in a couple of these cases, there's evidence to suggest that two of the couples would not have been on the parkway that night.
Meaning what?
This, to me, expands the killer's MO. We don't have to limit him to the parkway, meaning we also don't have to limit him to parkway victims. And we know that based off of the Teresa Howell case. She was nowhere near the parkway. She was at this Zodiac Club that was a popular nightclub. She vanishes. Her body's found hours later. So just we know by the timeline with that victim, not much could have occurred in her life or events in her life between the time she goes missing from leaving the club to when her body is found. She's found relatively quickly. It's a good thing because that was an easy way for them to collect evidence at the time. So that's 1989, the Teresa case. And that actually, the date that she is murdered I believe, would fall within the four case timeline. So it falls somewhere between the third case of Keith Call, Cassandra Haley, and then the fourth case, the Anna Marie Phelps and Daniel Lauer case, September 5th, 1989. Yeah, Teresa Howe was killed in July, according to my notes, of that same year. So she falls within that timeline. But the other thing is the MO. One has to look at this and go, he probably, I wish that we knew more about this case. And I'm going to, and I look, I understand that we're not perfect. We get things wrong. We don't always nail it in the garage. We do our best But one thing that was very disappointing in looking back on some of these cases, not the ones that fall into the Colonial Parkway murders category, but Teresa's case, there was very little media coverage of the case. I think that is partly because she was not from the area. She had moved to the area. I don't think she had family. She had family living states away,
right,
that were probably not there to pound the table and shout it from the mountaintops. And it sounds like police had very little leads to go on other than the fact that they knew that she left that nightclub. But one has to sit here and go, okay, how did the killer intercept her? It's always kind of been just generally thought that all of these eight victims were caught in some kind of net on the parkway the night that they were traveling. Again, two of these couples may have never been on the parkway that night at all. And so then you look at the Howell case. Could he have been in the nightclub himself?
Right.
Spots a young, attractive woman leaving on her own and decides to follow her into the parking lot. Could he have been in the nightclub earlier, positioned himself in the parking lot and thought, you know what, I'll wait till I see someone come out by themselves. And she just happened to be the one that he spots. Does he pull into the parking lot knowing I could find a young single person, a young single victim here?
He could sit there and wait, or like you said, he could go inside the bar. And if he did this at this club, he probably did it at several other clubs, sometimes being successful, sometimes not being successful.
That's the part that involves, when you go back to David Nobling and Robin Edwards as well, they're out at this Isle of Wight County Wildlife Refuge, Ragged Island. The way that that crime scene looks to me, so you have David Nobling, who is found shot near the shoreline, and then you find Robin Edwards, the other victim, who's found not terribly far from him, killed, shot and killed as well.
It's almost like this guy wanted to hunt every type of animal, and he decided that, oh, I'll just throw humans into that category as well.
I don't think that he drove David Nobling and Robin Edwards to Ragged Island Wildlife Refuge. In fact, David Nobling was known to go to this area to hang out,
right,
kind of like a party spot, right? And this is not the Colonial Parkway. I think he found them there and then moved the vehicle later.
Right.
Moved that Nobling's pickup to that small parking lot.
Which would make sense. And would throw law enforcement off the scent.
Which is off of the Colonial Parkway. So
yeah.
Now people are like, well, he caught him on the parkway and then moved the body. No. Look at those crime scenes. Nobody would come to the conclusion that they were transported to where they were killed. I think they were killed, and then after the fact, the vehicle was transported to where it was found in an attempt to throw the cops off. And in ways, it kind of worked because they weren't found for a couple of days.
And it also makes you wonder, and tell me if this is a dumb thought, because if he has a boat, is he traveling by car on some of these cases and maybe traveling by boat on other cases?
You're right. I think there's a chance that in the Nobling Edwards case that he stumbled onto those victims via boat, that he was right out there with the boat that night. We, as you pointed out, Captain, in episode one, he was an avid hunter, both bow hunter and with a gun. And usually some of those types are keeping a bow and or gun. And if you're a fisherman, knives with you most of the time. You're going to have those items on your boat. You're going to have them in your truck.
It's also not that hard to get people onto your boat. You strike up a conversation with people at a bar. Hey, oh yeah, well, you know, I walked here. Well, I actually took my boat. Oh, would you guys like to go for a ride?
I've seen too many movies to get onto a stranger's boat.
Well, see, I'm the captain, so whatever boat I go on, I own.
I'm pointing out how these murders could have taken place, and in fact, the three that he's responsible for may not have involved the Parkway at all, other than he moved the pickup truck to off of that Parkway.
Again, it's a lot easier to move a vehicle than it would be to move victims.
Well, and this is returning us now to, let's take that information that we've just discussed and revisit the Keith Call Cassandra Haley case, the two that have never been found, the two that were together at a college party. Leaving that college party, Keith Call was going to drive Cassandra Haley home. And in fact, all the evidence points to that because she had a curfew and they left the party with roughly the right amount of time to drive straight from the party to her home to return her to her parents' home in right. time for the curfew. That route, the fastest route from point A to point B, did not involve the Parkway at all.
Right.
I'm pointing out the situation with Teresa Howell's case because if the killer, if Wilmer intercepted her before she could get to her vehicle in the parking lot that night, we're talking, it's like 2 or 3 in the morning.
Right.
Could we have another scenario where in 1988, where he's parked somewhere around this college party, wherever this college party took place, and saw the two of them?
Well, he would have been what, late 20s, early 30s. So it wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility that he could just go into a party.
Yeah, I don't know that he...
I'm not saying that he would. I'm just saying that, like, he wouldn't... It wasn't like he was in his 60s when these crimes were committed. So it wouldn't... If he's at a bar, if he's hanging around a college, he's not going to stick out like a sore thumb.
Right. He is younger looking, I would say. So
and
I
also
have a
he's shorter. So sometimes when an individual's shorter, sometimes you just kind of assume their age as being younger.
Could be. Every short. So you're like, hey, that guy's short. He must be in college. Now, so I'm just saying that
if you saw him from a distance, maybe you wouldn't even think college student. You might think high school student if you saw him from a distance.
I'm going to have to push back because I don't think he would have fit into the college party at all. I mean, we're talking, he would have been 34 years old.
Right.
And he's an outdoorsman. Like, I'm not saying it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility, but I don't think he was hanging out with these college kids. You're not factoring in another part of this equation. The other part of this equation is the police are the persons that attended this party. This wasn't, this wasn't a 4-person, 5-person, 10-person party. This was a larger party. They interviewed these individuals. If they talk to multiple people and they're like, yeah, there was this short old guy that was here,
right,
which was seemed kind of odd, that's going to stand out to them in their notes. Again, not out of the realm of possibility, but I'm also speculating as well, so I can't fault you for that. My speculation is it a possibility that he saw them leaving,
right,
intercepts them in the parking lot, or somehow figures out I can fake pull these people over, which that was always one thought to be considered right. in the Parkway cases. But again, pointing out that the Parkway does not involve these two individuals who he is the prime suspect of their disappearance in 1988.
Okay, question for you. If we're trying to profile this individual, this penis dick balls, right? Is he the type of killer? Do you think he's the type of killer that he's in stealth mode where he's, I'm going to sit in the parking lot, I'm going to stalk, I'm going to hunt my prey that way? Or is he, I'm going to go into the bar, I'm going to make conversation, I'm going to find my individual that way, and then I'll follow them out of the bar? Because to me, because of his hunting background, fishing background, he's a stealth mode, lie away and wait type of killer.
Yeah, but I don't think he's a stalker. right? I don't think that any of these victims fell prey to him because he had been watching them for a considerable amount of time.
No, I meant stalking in the moment.
Of course. Yeah. Right. So I think what we have here is an opportunistic killer. He goes out looking for a victim, and some nights he finds them and some nights he does not.
And he'd be patient. I mean, you have to have patience if you're into the sport of hunting or fishing. So that makes him very lethal, because he can lie and wait for the perfect opportunity.
Well, and the opportunity is going to not just be when the victim presents themselves, but also when the situation presents itself as being the right situation.
Right.
I'm not going to be seen by somebody else. Or when I gain control of these victims, there's not going to be eyewitnesses or ear witnesses.
Well, no, and we almost have proof of that. And maybe you can back me up on this. We have individuals that say, well, this guy pulled us over. This guy approached us.
In all scenarios, it's approached, which is, I think, key, because one of the theories over the years was that maybe this person had a law enforcement background or was pretending to be law enforcement, because in some scenarios, it looked like these individuals had been pulled over. I think that's exaggerated a little bit. I think what we have here, most of these scenarios, is they're either the victims are intercepted before they can get to their cars or outside of their cars. Like we know, I believe in the Nobling Edwards case that we're saying he absolutely did do.
But these other scenarios, I mean, when he's approaching these people, they obviously didn't get killed. So there was something that he didn't think was right about the situation or the opportunity. If you can connect the 8 Parkway murders and this other victim, this could just be the beginning.
Or the end, or the middle. And that's what I want to talk about here today. The potential for other cases and potentially expanding the timeline of this killer and who are the other victims that he's responsible for. He would have been 32 years of age roughly when the first Colonial Parkway murder took place. And we've talked about this plenty of times, that the average age of a serial killer, an active serial killer, is their late 20s.
Your expertise lends you to believe that this is not the start of his murders.
I would wager a Franklin that he killed before the Parkway murders started in 86. And I would wager another Franklin that he killed after he killed Teresa Howell in 1989.
Right.
So some other cases to be considered. One that stands out is the murder of Belinda Ann Ashburn, who would have been about 33 years of age when she was killed. Her body was found in North Carolina. And so immediately some people are going to go, well, all these other cases you've talked about took place in Virginia. Yes, that's true. They took place on the east coast of Virginia. But if you look at the Isle of Wight case that we know that he would be tried with, they would take him to trial, arrest him for and try him for the double murder in the Isle of Wight case.
Right.
That is a southern county in Virginia. And then you have North Carolina, of course, that is just south of the state of Virginia. In the Ashburn case, in the Belinda Ashburn case, she is found in the water in Currituck County, which is East Coast, the most northern county on that East Coast. So we're talking, it's right on the Virginia-North Carolina border. There's not a whole lot of information about her case out there. And sadly, I found what information I did find sounds like there was not a great investigation that took place with her murder. One piece of information that we found was saying that her father was conducting his own investigation. And in our experience, Captain, when does that take place? We see that when either the family doesn't think that the police are doing a good enough job, or if their investigation is not really taking place.
Right.
So here's what we do know. Belinda Ann Ashburn, 33, she was from Chesapeake, Virginia. That is this man's general hunting area. That is where he was looking for victims. And we have proof of that by the three known victims that we have.
Correct.
Chesapeake, Virginia. She was found floating in a canal in Currituck County. And I apologize if I'm not saying that correctly. That's how I believe it to be said, but I didn't have the time to ask around.
Been wrong before.
Yeah. So you can
stick that in your hat and smoke it.
Well, yeah. It's right on the Virginia, North Carolina line. This was in 1988. Listen to this detail, though. This is a detail that very much mirrors some of the details of the previous cases that we've discussed. Her car was found earlier the day that she was found, abandoned at the south end of Blackwater Road with the keys in the ignition. Okay, two of the other cases both had keys in the ignition.
It's almost like a calling card.
The front door open.
Yeah, another calling card.
A purse containing $300. We found in all these other cases, or most of these other cases, I should say,
right,
money on the persons, money in the vehicles. We've also found valuables on the victims that were left. The killer could have taken jewelry, could have taken money, could have taken items of value, but did not. That was not a part of what he wanted to do or wanted to bother to do. Her clothing and other personal items were found on the seat of her vehicle. So she's found either nude or partially clad, sexually assaulted, and floating in a canal. And in fact, I'll read the information about her father. And sadly, her parents are no longer with us. But I still have hope that this case could be solved. I just wish that her parents would have gotten answers before they had grown too old. So her father's name is Robert Zernheld. He lived at Virginia Beach. This article says the murder of his daughter, Belinda Ashburn, has been an all-consuming. For the last 6 months, he has been investigating her death and interviewing anyone who might know something. Quote, you never get over this type of thing, Zernheld said. I never sleep anymore unless it's with a sedative. I spend 3 to 4 hours a day running leads. So her family gets together with some of the other families of the Colonial Parkway murders, and they were trying to raise money and petition the state of Virginia to create a task force to look into these unsolved murders. This also includes murders that were not linked to the Colonial Parkway.
Right.
There was a task force that was assembled at some point, but one problem that we discussed back in 2018 was that a lot of these cases took place in different jurisdictions.
Yeah, so the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing.
Or would bother to even tell the other hand what we were doing. Two is some of this land is federal land. So you have state law enforcement, you have local law enforcement, and you have federal law enforcement, all either involved or not involved. And in some cases, I believe, pointing the finger saying, no, that's not our case, that's their case. It was almost the perfect crime. Everyone was distracted, their attention elsewhere. Stacks of cold hard cash sitting on the table unguarded. Who wouldn't be tempted to slowly reach their hand out and steal a pile of Monopoly money from the banker? Monopoly is one of those games that can bring out everyone's most devious selves. And Monopoly Go takes that gleeful mischievousness to your phone in a wildly popular twist on the classic game that you can play throughout your day, anywhere, anytime. Collect rent from friends on iconic properties, bankrupt them by pulling a heist on their vault, and Monopoly Go has timed tournaments where you can team up with friends to unlock big prizes and try to top the leaderboards. Whether you're helping out your friends or going head-to-head for riches, Monopoly Go is an absolute blast. Download it now free on the App Store or Google Play. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? minds feeling a little drained. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/garage today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/garage. Have you ever thought about why your wireless bill is so damn expensive? It's all just radio waves. And how much can radio waves really cost? It seems like big wireless all got together and decided $100 a month. Now, thanks to Mint Mobile, you have a choice. For a limited time, all phone plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plan's jaw-dropping monthly bills and unexpected overages. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. So ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited-time deal and get premium wireless for just $15 a month. I love Mint Mobile. They have great quality. They have wonderful service. I love saving money. Put them together, and I'm getting great quality, great service, a wonderful phone plan for only $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
All right, tell your mama, tell your papa to listen to the True Crime Garage. And cheers to you all. Cheers to you, Colonel.
Cheers to you, Captain. Cheers to the people in the back, of course.
Yeah, get you some.
Amber Lundgren is one that has been mentioned with the recent development of Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. being properly referred to as a serial killer by Virginia State Police. This is one that the police have not lumped her in with the other victims, but we have very smart podcasters and people on social media saying, wait a second, this Amber Lundgren case feels very familiar. In fact, it feels a lot like the Teresa Howe case. So Amber Lundgren, very similar situation. She's down in Asheville. So that puts her a considerable distance from some of these other cases that we've discussed. Keep in mind, at this time in our timeline, when she goes missing and then later is found, we believe, and the authorities believe, that Alan Wade Wilmer Sr. had moved on from the Waterman business and was now doing the tree service business. And there were storms, severe storms in this area prior to her death. So he could have been down there chasing work like we talked about. I'll point out one problem that I find with linking him to this case. But before I get to that, here's the things that are similarities.
Okay.
Amber Lundgren is 20 years of age at the time. She reportedly, by her friends, somehow they're out together. She's out with a group of friends, and she gets separated from these friends. She's leaving a downtown nightclub around. It's believed this, I wrote 2:30 a.m. in my notes. I've seen as early as 2 a.m. I've seen as late as 3 a.m. Most reports are saying 2:30 a.m. This is on June 7th, 1997. So this would be 8 years after the believed last Parkway murders, and it would be 8 years after the killing of Teresa Howe. But
he'd still be in his 40s.
Here's the victim who's leaving a nightclub late 2:30 a.m. That's roughly about the same time that Teresa would have been leaving the Zodiac Club years right. prior. It's believed that she was last seen on Lexington Avenue. I'm not familiar with this area. Her body was eventually found on Azalea Road. This is near a recreation park in East Asheville. There was a description from a potential eyewitness or possible eyewitnesses who said that they spotted a man between 3 and 4 a.m. on that day on Azalea Road, standing near an older, dark-colored pickup truck with a utility bed. Okay. So right there, the older colored pickup truck, mm-hmm. similar to something that we've already discussed. We do know that he painted his truck. I can't speak to what colors when, but we do know the pictures that are circulating today of that 1966 Dodge truck. It's a blue truck, which may even appear to be even darker, right? In a low light, middle setting, of the night yeah. situation. The man was described as between 20 and 45 years of age. That doesn't help us a whole lot because that's a wide age range. But he would fall somewhere into that category, I believe. I'd have to check my math here. Closer to the end of that 45, 46 years old. The thing, though, that stands out as being possible connection, dark reddish brown hair and a beard. And we're going to put out yeah. some pictures. And this would make some sense. A stocky build. That makes sense. Was always described as very short and muscular. So maybe even a stocky appearance. The problem here is the next piece of the description is medium height.
Well, some would say he had an athletic George Costanza build.
Maybe, and it's a stretch, pun intended. Maybe if he's wearing boots as tree trimmer outdoorsman would suggest is likely or a possibility. Maybe he's looking a little bit taller. I don't know if I got 100 people in a room, if any of them would describe 5'5" tall for a male, full-grown male as medium height. I certainly wouldn't describe that as medium height. Lundgren was 5'4" tall. So keep in mind, if they see this man near her, or they don't have much of a point of reference of how tall he could be, maybe medium height was just playing it safe with the description.
It's also tough too, because sometimes shorter people look taller when they sit down. It all depends on how, like I'm a pretty tall guy, but I can sit next to people because I have very long legs and we look like we're similar in height. But once I stand up, I tower over them.
Well, and I think you will see police did have a sketch of the person that was seen standing near this dark pickup truck, as well as a sketch of the pickup truck itself. I don't love the written description of that truck where it says a utility bed, and maybe I have a different understanding of a utility bed. For some reason, the first picture that I get, Captain, is like more of a flat bed, but I guess utility bed would also maybe
I'd have like buckets on the side.
Buckets on the side, or those big lock toolboxes in the back.
Right.
Which his truck certainly had that. And we will post those pictures and this sketch on our social media. And I believe that we're going to get a lot of people that will go, yeah, I can see the connection here. Now, back in 2018, may or may not be related to the Colonial Parkways murders, but we did discuss the case of David Lee Metzer, age 19, of Lynchburg, and Heidi Lynn Childs, 18, of Forest. They were both Virginia Tech students. In 2009, a man walking his dog found their bodies in a parking lot of a wildlife and campground area in the Jefferson National Forest. This was a popular hangout spot for Virginia Tech students. Both had been shot with a 30-30 caliber hunting rifle. David's body was found in his vehicle, and Heidi's body was found outside of the vehicle. And the campground is about 15 miles from Virginia Tech's campus in Blacksburg, which is a little more than a 3-hour drive to the Colonial Parkway. So this one is kind of well off the way there. But again, the gun used is a similarity.
Yeah,
the vehicle situation.
And again,
yeah, and we have even the victims that are not found near the parkway or ties to the parkway. What is a constant that we're hearing? Victim found in wooded area or forest type area, wildlife preserve, wildlife refuge, all places that we could imagine someone with the lifestyle of Alan Wilmer being out hunting. And yeah, maybe it's not humans that he's hunting that night, but he comes across somebody else in the process.
Right. But he's also familiar with those areas. And we know serial killers like to kill people or take their victims to places that they're familiar with. It feels safer there. I think the other thing too is, like, do you find something strange about the age of the victims? It all seems like they're of a younger, like, student age. And maybe it's just because those would be the people that would be out later. And maybe that's the time of night that he is comfortable with looking for victims. But I'd also want to know, did something happen in his past around that age where he's targeting people of a younger age? Does that make any sense at all?
Both make sense. And I think what you're hitting on here that I would really lean toward is what you said at the start of that I believe him to be a very opportunistic type of killer. And as you said, younger people tend to be out later, and it just may be happenstance that those are the persons that he's finding when he's out looking.
Yeah.
That's why it's disappointing to not have more information in the Belinda Ashburn case, because while it shares so many similarities, again, the water is the key here with this perpetrator. I believe she's found in the water in a canal, and we don't know the situation of, well, when was she last seen, or where do we believe she was traveling to?
Uh-huh.
And at what time of day would that have been? And why I would want to know that is because she is older than most of the victims that we've discussed. Like, I believe the oldest of the victims that we've discussed so far is 27 years old, Kathy Thomas. And Belinda is 33. She's a young looking 33 from the pictures I've seen. But again, we don't know enough about her case other than the similarities that we've already covered. Some other ones that are potential. This would be rather early in our timeline. So this would put us in 1979. Alice Askew, who was killed in September of 1979. Her body was found in a densely wooded area of Seashore State Park. Other than the manner and where she was found and her age, she was 18. Petite white female. Those are really the only similarities. One case here that stands out to me, which I would love to know some more details, is Joan Zwigman and Christine Pilzak. This is August of 1983. These two women were from out of town. They had traveled to the area together to Virginia Beach to attend a convention related to their employment. They were last seen at night at approximately 7 p.m. on August 18th, 1983. Unfortunately, they were found by the Coast Guard. A pilot boat operator had notified the Coast Guard of two bodies floating in the water. These victims were both 26 years of age. Again, the water is important to me in this case here. And it's only a few years prior to the Colonial Parkway murders. Rafaela Bryant, July 1985. This was a car fire. So she had been killed and the vehicle was set on fire.
Which we know in one of the other cases they tried to do.
It was an attempt, yes.
Right.
So her case is interesting as well. Those three cases that we've just discussed, those are all considered to be cold cases. The investigating agency on that one, on all three, are the Virginia Beach Police.
Well, and I know this goes without saying, and we have a lot of intelligent individuals that listen to this podcast, a lot of sleuthers out there. And if you're a sleuther and you're going, hey, this is kind of interesting, and I'm going to dive into some cases in this area. If you see a similarity, look, reach out to law enforcement. Let them know. It might be something that they, a case that they're not aware of that has similarities. Anybody looking for information to solve these cases, it's a good thing. The more people that can, we can connect more crimes to this individual. I don't think these three will be the only cases that he's found guilty of.
Correct. If they have the evidence, then becomes
right.
What do they have and what can they prove? When we elevate him to what the state is saying, serial killer, now you have to look at him. And I'm not trying to pull one of these situations where it's like, oh, we've identified a new serial killer, so he must be responsible for the murders of every unsolved murder that took place during his lifetime in the state of Virginia. We're not trying to do that here, because there were other cases that we looked at and we said, no, this doesn't make sense like some of these other cases may make sense. Now, we haven't got to the one that makes the most sense. And this is probably, this is a case with a lot of twists and turns, and a case that maybe some of the listeners out there may be familiar with. So this case takes place in Virginia. So right now, right away, we've checked a box. This is the still unsolved murder of Mary Harding. Her last name's Harding. Her middle name, I'm not sure how to say that. Mary Harding was a young mother of two. She was married to a man named Emerson Harding. They live in Lancaster County, Virginia, which at the time, back in 1985, when she was killed, had a population of roughly 10,000 people. Still has that small population to this day. Flags were raised, Captain, when she is found missing from their home. So her husband, Emerson, he is, like many people, he works the waters. Okay, so in Lancaster County, most men, pretty broad statement here, but most men back then worked the waters. Most of them worked big corporate ships in Chesapeake Bay, either crab or oysters off of the Rappahannock, I believe is how you say it, river. Her husband works the waters, and the way that his schedule works, he's gone a lot due to the trade. This is a very low, extremely low crime area, extremely low violent crime area. So when this murder took place, it freaked everybody out, of course. So what we have here is Mary Harding is, she works part-time at the Bank of Lancaster. As said, her husband is gone oftentimes for days and many times overnight and for days working on the waters. Because of their careers with the two small kids, she would often drop them off with a relative to be watched when she would go work her Bank of Lancaster shift. She was scheduled to drop them off at, I believe it was her grandmother's, or either her husband's grandmother or her grandmother's house on Friday, August 23rd, 1985. She didn't drop them off as scheduled. Grandmother makes a phone call, nobody answers. So grandma decides to drive out. When she gets to the house, the kids are fine. In fact, the little boy, he's like 4 or 5. He opens up the door and he's like, mom's gone.
Right.
And dad's out working on the boats. He's been gone for a couple of days.
Not good.
No. Grandma knows that this is not a situation that the parents would have at all. So she calls the police. Police arrive on the scene and here's what they find. They find the kids' food from the night before, still out on the table. They find Comet or Ajax in the sink, you know, like the cleaning
It's like cleaning scrub.
They find the kitty litter box outside of the back door, and it looks like it had been like dropped. They find one of her flip-flops near the kitty litter box, and then out on the driveway, they find her second flip-flop. This is painting a picture for detectives here. What it looks like is that she had put the kids to bed. They're both very young kids. The boy's the oldest. He's only 4 or 5. Fed them dinner, put them to bed, and was in the process of like cleaning the house once she got some time to herself. And somebody grabbed her, startled her. Something startled her when she was outside dealing with the kitty litter box. She hadn't cleaned up the dinner from the night before. She hadn't scrubbed out the sink, as it would appear was her intention. And then these flip-flops are found outside. So they very quickly figure out she's been abducted.
But this is also a very different way of finding a victim.
Compared to the cases that we've discussed, 100%.
Right.
On August 27th, her body is found floating face down in that Rappahannock River. Okay, so she has been strangled, and this is just off of a location called Belle Isle. The body's naked, bloated, no clothing, cuts and slashes are on her back, rope is around her neck, a large cinder block with a heavy chain was connecting the right leg to that same rope that was connected to the cinder block. So somebody abducted her, killed her, and attempted to conceal the body by throwing her in the water and weighting her down. Police do point out at the time, look, this is all things that we would expect a boat person or waterman type of equipment used to weight her down. Now, we should also say it's not terribly uncommon for people to have rope, heavy chain, or cinder blocks that don't own a boat or don't work in that line of work.
Yeah, Scott Peterson.
There was a $20,000 reward offered, and eventually this leads to an arrest. So she's reported missing on Friday, August 23rd, body found August 27th, weighted down in the river. The problem was where they attempted to conceal the body, it wasn't very deep. So even though they weighted her down, at some point, somebody passing by, she's kind of visible to somebody floating face down in the river. And that's how they find the body. Now, right. An arrest was made that Halloween. So roughly 2 months later, the person that is arrested, his name is Emerson Stevens. He's a waterman. At the time, he owned a 32-foot boat named the Miss Sandra. He lived nearby. And it was the reward money that kind of led some tipsters to come forward. And the tips that they were getting was that a pickup truck had been spotted near her home late on the night that it's believed that she was abducted. He owned a pickup truck.
Was it an old style pickup truck?
There's some problems with this case. Okay. So, yeah. The problems are going to be the description of the pickup truck. You get multiple persons saying that they saw a pickup truck there that night. You're going to get one person that's going to say, not only did I see a pickup truck there that night, but here's the description. And oh, by the way, I know somebody that owns a pickup truck exactly like that. And by the way, I know whose truck that was.
Yeah.
So this guy comes forward and says, this truck belongs to Emerson Stevens. He's my cousin. That's the truck that I saw out there that night. Mm. I want everybody to please understand this. There's other witnesses that gave a slightly different versions of the description of that pickup truck.
Right.
I'm pointing that out because Emerson Stevens is arrested, as said, on Halloween. He's later tried for this murder. The first trial gets a hung jury. They take it back to trial again. He gets convicted. He's going to be sentenced to life. He's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. That should be the end of the case, correct? Well, it's not. He spends several decades in prison.
Wow.
He's always sticks to saying that he's innocent. He was married with children of his own at the time. And in fact, he tells his wife, hey, divorce me, move on with your life. I'm stuck here forever. You need to go out and live your life.
I'd say, honey, you got to wait for me. I don't care what you have to do. You got to wait for me.
Some of the other information that helped to convict him was he owned a wildcat, what's called a wildcat Skinner knife, which, okay, might seem damning in some cases, but he's a fisherman. He's a waterman. Like most people in that area, most of these types will carry knives or at least have them on their boats.
Yeah.
And he owned a boat. What happens is once they hone in on Stevenson, Stevens, because of the cousin coming forward saying that, oh, that was my cousin Stevens' truck that I saw out there that night. Once they hone in on Emerson Stevens, one of the persons close to him that they talked to says, yeah, he had this wildcat Skinner knife, and then all of a sudden he didn't have it anymore. He had this nice knife that he carried in a leather sheath, and all of a sudden he didn't have it anymore. And that was roughly around the time that woman disappeared. So now the detectives are like, okay, we know what caused the slashes, the cuts to this woman's back. And he knew to weight her down because he was a fisherman. He was a waterman. Weighted her down in the water. He gets convicted, spends several decades in prison, and then he finds someone to take his case. He's spending his time writing to the governor, writing to judges, writing to lawyers. Eventually finds somebody to take his case. And his case gets released from prison. They find that the evidence is completely bunk. Some of the evidence they found was hair. They found a hair sample in his truck that an expert had said matched that of the victims.
Not so fast.
One of the persons that helped to get him released was that same expert who reviewed the hair later with advanced technology and requested bringing in other experts to consult with. And they came to the determination that the hair did not come from the victim. So now you got to toss out that evidence. The truck, I saw my cousin's truck out there that night. They figured out that cousin lied. I shouldn't say that they figured out that he lied. It's suspected now today that he lied because after the conviction, he keeps calling the police going, hey, what about that reward money? Hey, what about that reward money? When right. can I get that $20,000 that you guys were offering for a conviction here? So not only does Emerson Stevens get released from prison, but listen to this.
I'm listening.
He was convicted in 1986. Many years later, I think it's 2016 or 17, he gets released. Let's take this step further, a very necessary step further. In August of 2021, he receives a full pardon. An absolute pardon. Meaning, this is not a situation where we've reviewed it and gone, oh, we question all the evidence, we got to let this guy out. No, this is now a situation we've reviewed all the evidence and we can say that he did not kill this woman. This case is still unsolved. Well, why is this one that we want to point to very strongly for somebody like Alan Wade Wilmer Sr.? When you go back and review the other suspects in this woman's murder, there's one that stands out from the handful that they were looking at. A man by the name of Keith Wilmer, a waterman, and he's a husband of one of Mary's co-workers. So let's do the full reveal here, Captain. Keith Wilmer is Alan Wilmer's brother, who he lived with off and on during the 80s and 90s.
So it's possible that he fancied her and knew that the husband was going to be out of town. The husband was going to be working. So show up at her house.
Keith Wilmer was one of a very few suspects in this murder. Keith Wilmer housed his brother, who turns out to be known now in 2024 as a serial killer, and Keith's wife worked at the same bank with Mary Harding. What I'm getting at here is, do we live in a world where both of these brothers who lived together individually were killing people without the other knowing, or even more so, did they do any of these things together?
It's a sick world.
So Keith Wilmer becomes on the police radar for the Mary Harding case back in 1985 because, one, he's married to one of her coworkers. It became known to the police that he was calling people. He was doing these obscene phone calls. Okay, and this was with more than one person, not with the victim, but with more than one woman who he was calling, and he was saying things like he wanted to have sex with them in the woods and very kind of gross stuff. So he ends up on police radar. But keep in mind, the guy that they convicted, it's very strange to me that Keith Wilmer has the same occupation as the guy they convict. He's a waterman. Right. His brother's a waterman. The body is found floating in the river, weighed down with things that one might expect to find on a boat.
And these also seem to be sexually motivated crimes.
Yes, she was raped and murdered.
Right. And so you have a guy making sick phone calls to women. That's a red flag. That's something you shouldn't do. That's something you don't talk about at parties.
They were able to determine that the slashes on Mary Harding's back did not come from a knife. Remember, she was found in shallow water. They figured out that those occurred post-mortem after she was weighed down, that the propellers of a boat or two had gone over top of her. Her body was found, I'm trying to find the exact description here. I believe it was like her body was found 600 feet from where Keith Wilmer kept his boat, where he docked his boat. Now, to be fair to Keith Wilmer, other people docked their boat in the same area. This is very close. This is really starting to shrink the degrees of separation between a now known serial killer and a victim of an unsolved homicide. At the time, we should point out that Keith Wilmer's home was searched. He did allow police to search his house, his boat, and his truck. Note that he's driving a truck at the time. He did submit to a polygraph exam, which the results are listed as inconclusive.
Yeah, results may vary.
Alan Wade Wilmer, we know he was looked at, home searched, boat searched, truck searched, after the third of the four Colonial Parkway murders. And they give him a polygraph exam and he passes. And so that's why he was listed as cleared. Great suspect. We cleared him because he passed the polygraph, which we know you don't do that. You should not do that. And when they search his home, they find everything you would expect to find: guns, knives, handcuffs, pornography. Those are all things that you would expect to find from somebody that you later learn has killed three people. Now, he's a hunter and a fisherman, so you expect to find guns and knives. And of course, they found those in Keith Wilmer's. But what I'm getting at here, Captain, is did the two live together at this time? Did they go and carry this out together? I have a hard time believing that serial killer brother Alan Wilmer went out and did this and Keith was totally oblivious to it. I have a hard time believing that. And then you have to go a step further when you look at some of the other homicides, right? We talked about this back when we did our 2018 coverage of, at the time, what was 8 unsolved homicides. We went through some
killer
of
or two.
The offender profile, exactly, that the offender was organized, because he brought, there are things that are suggestive of being an organized killer. He brought weapons along with him, was able to control victims before killing them. never mutilated or molested their bodies. Well, molested appears after the fact. Concealed the corpses, or at least attempted to. Waited periods of time before striking again.
Yeah.
And there was the self-control of refraining from publicly taunting police, law enforcement, with letters to the media or to law enforcement. And in a couple of the cases, I would say that it's suggestive that the modus operandi was changing. So, like, we're kind of dancing around here, and as you just said, Captain, how could one perpetrator manage to kill two victims, and in some cases by hand, without the other victim escaping? That's when you have to go, well, are we looking at a situation where we have one killer or two killer? To be perfectly clear here, the forensic evidence in the three cases that have been solved only suggest one killer, a one killer right. scenario. However, we've just discussed multiple unsolved cases where we don't have the answers to. And until we have those answers, we just don't know. Was it one or was it two?
Want to thank everybody for joining us here in the garage each and every week. Make sure you call your mother, call your father, call your best friend. Text them right now if you have to and say, listen to True Crime Garage. Keeps the lights on, people. It keeps the lights on. Colonel, do we have any recommended reading for the beautiful listeners?
Yes, we do, Captain. I'm very happy to be recommending A Special Kind of Evil, The Colonial Parkway Serial Killings. This was released back in 2018. And we recommended it back then. I love this book. This is the best book regarding the Colonial Parkway serial killings and one of the best writing duos for true crime today. So we have father-daughter true crime authors Blaine Pardoe and Victoria Hester for this book, A Special Kind of Evil. For their writing and research, they blew the dust off of these old cases before they heated up again. They interviewed family members, friends, and members of law enforcement, and they provide the first and most complete in-depth look at this string of horrific murders and disappearances. The author investigators peel back the rumors and myths surrounding these crimes and provide new information never before revealed about the investigations. You will want to check out A Special Kind of Evil, and you will also want to check out our other recommendations that we have listed for you on our recommended page on our website, truecrimegarage.com.
And make sure you sign up on the mailing list. Until next week, be good, be kind, and don't litter.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.